Rama Rama Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 1, The Activities of Maharaj Priyavrata, Text 9. So this part of the Srimad Bhagavatam is written in Sanskrit prose, not verse. You know, that's why you can't chant the verses, like Bhagavad Gita verses or something like that. So, you know, just read it through. It's meant to be read through, not broken into lines like verses. So I'll read it through. If somebody else wants to try to read it through, you can do that. Okay. Tatrahava enam devarshirham sayanena pitaram bhagavantam hiranyagarbham upalabdha manaha sahasaivotayarhanena sahapita putrabhyam Avahitanjalir Upataste. Anybody else want to read it? Okay. So we'll do the word for word. Tatra. There. Hava. Certainly. Enam. Him. Deva Rishahi. The great Saint Narada. Hamsayanena, by the swan carrier. Pitaram, his father. Bhagavantam, most powerful. Hiranyagarbham, Lord Brahma. Upalabdhamanaha, understanding. Sasa eva, immediately. Utaya, having stood up. Arhanena, with paraphernalia for worship. Saha, accompanied. Pitaputrabhyam, by Priyavrata and his father. Swayambhuvamanu. Avihita Anjalihi, with respect and folded hands. Upataste, worship. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. So please repeat. Lord Brahma, the father of Narada Muni, is the supreme person within the universe. As soon as Narada saw the great swan, he could understand that Lord Brahma had arrived. Therefore, he immediately stood up, along with Swayambhuvamanu and his son Priyavrata, whom Narada was instructing. They folded their hands and began to worship Lord Brahma with great respect. Purport. As stated in the previous verse, Lord Brahma was accompanied by other demigods, but his specific carrier was the great swan. Therefore, as soon as Narada Muni saw the swan, he could understand that his father, Lord Brahma, who is also known as Hiranyagarbha, was arriving. Thus, he immediately stood up with Swayambhuva Manu and his son, Priyavrata, to receive Lord Brahma and offer him respect. Om Gyanatimrandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Militamyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So here we learn that Lord Brahma is arriving in his swan carrier. In the third canto, chapter 24, text 20, in his purport, Srila Prabhupada points out that this swan carrier is a vehicle that looks like a swan. And it's not apparently, you know, like an animal. So this is a kind of vimana or spacecraft or aircraft. And we find in the Srimad Bhagavatam descriptions of many kinds of spacecraft, which is, you know, very challenging to the modern mind, you know, because they think that airplanes and things like that were invented in the 20th century, you know, by the Wright brothers or things like that. So they have a mistaken idea about the history of technology. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we get information that the history of technology is different than what, you know, most scientists and historians now believe. You know, in ancient times, you know, there were descriptions of these vimanas or spacecraft being written long before, you know, Western culture had any knowledge of these things. So there are different kinds of, you know, vimanas, you know, described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. One type of vimana is the kind used by the demons. And for example, we find that the demon Shalva had a vimana or a kind of airplane that he used. It said it was made of metal. it had some pretty unusual, you know, powers. You know, it could fly here and there in a very unusual way. You know, kind of a movement like a butterfly. Like you see a butterfly flying, it doesn't go in a straight line. It's kind of going back and forth here and there, making movements that an ordinary, you know, airplane really can't make. And sometimes it would appear and disappear. It would appear in two places at once. So it had some pretty unusual characteristics of flight. And then there are the vimanas used by the demigods to travel not just from place to place on Earth or between, you know, the lower planets, but they could go up to the higher planets, just like we see Lord Brahma. He's using his swan carrier to come down from Brahmaloka, which is the highest material planet. And so the demigods have their vimanas that they use to fly from place to place. And they're made of a kind of subtle machinery. not made of ordinary metal and things like that. And then there are the Vaikuntha airplanes. You know, like we see, there are several instances in the Srimad Bhagavatam where, I think for Dhruva Maharaj and his mother, there were Vaikuntha airplanes that came to take them from the material world to the Vaikuntha planets. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we also see descriptions of the Vaikuntha planets, where it's said that the inhabitants of the Vaikuntha planets, sometimes they're flying in the spiritual sky there, and these, you know, Vaikuntha airplanes. So these airplanes had, or spaceships had, very unusual powers. Of course, some personalities were able to make these journeys without any kind of vimana or spacecraft or aircraft. For example, Narada Muni, you know, he can travel throughout the universe, you know, to the Vaikuntha planets, to the heavenly planets, anywhere, simply by, you know, his own mystic power. There are other yogis that also have those abilities. You know, they can travel from planet to planet simply, you know, by mystic powers. But here we're learning about, you know, some other kind of way of traveling by, you know, vimanas. And of course today, you know, we have, you know, our airplanes and things like that, but they're of a different sort. Or sometimes they try to make them very elaborate. Like the President of the United States, you know, he flies around in a, you know, big 747 that's got, you know, an office, a bedroom in it, and things like that. And some of these Arabian sheiks, they've also got 747s that are completely decked out with swimming pools, saunas, things like that. But none of them can actually compare, for example, with the vimana that was created by Kardama Muni. Like Kardama Muni, you know, manifested by his yogic power a vimana that was like a huge palace, and that he could travel from, he could travel with his wife, you know, Devahuti, from planet to planet, go to the gardens of the demigods and things like that. So usually these these vimanas are manufactured by mantra. They're manufactured and controlled by mantras or by, you know, mystic powers. Whereas, you know, if we want to build some aircraft, you know, we have to dig in the ground for minerals and refine them in factories, you know, to get metals, or have huge factories to make plastics and things like that. And then we have to have hundreds of engineers and workers, you know, put together these things. And even then, they're not so perfect. You know, occasionally they're crashing and things like that. And they're really not so comfortable, you know, to fly in. You know, if you've ever had to, you know, travel a lot, you know, by airplane, you know, you see it's really not so comfortable. So these vimanas that are described in, you know, the Srimad Bhagavatam are a little bit different than that. So this is a higher kind of science. You know, these, you know, the demigods and the yogis, you know, they understood, you know, the principles of this higher science, which involves being able to manipulate, you know, subtle energies in ways that, you know, we we really don't understand these days. So, another topic here is how Brahma, he's actually the first living being in the universe. We're actually all descended in one way or another from Lord Brahma. This is, in one sense, this is somewhat similar to an idea that Darwin had. You know, when Darwin was living in the 19th century, the main idea that scientists had about the origin of species was that God created each species separately. In other words, there are millions of species, and they thought, being Christians at that time, many of them, that God must have designed and manufactured each species separately. You know, he made the frog separately, the bird separately. But Darwin's insight was to say, no, there's so many similarities between these different kinds of living things. They must have all come from some common ancestor. And actually, from the standpoint of the Vedic cosmology, the Bhagavatam cosmology, we would agree that yes, we don't learn from the Bhagavatam that God creates each species separately. No, he makes Brahma, and then from Brahma come the Prajapatis, and then from the Prajapatis come all the different kinds of plants and animals and things like that. Like in the sixth canto, the Bhagavatam, we'll learn about the daughters of Daksha. Daksha's a Prajapati, but he's a son of Brahma. Yeah, he comes from Brahma. First there's Brahma, then there's the Prajapatis, then they have the job of producing the bodies of all the different kinds of plants and animals and things like that. So in the sixth canto, we learn that first Daksha tried to mentally create all the bodies of the living things, but he messed it up somehow. It didn't work. So then he thought, okay, I'll use my sons to produce the bodies of all the living things. But Narada Muni messed that up for him. Narada Muni convinced his sons to be brahmacharis. So then he thought, okay, I'll use my daughters. See, Narada Muni won't bother them. Yeah, because he's strict brahmachari. He won't hang out with these girls. So he gave his daughters to different demigods and sages, and by their reproductive activities, they produced the bodies of the plants, the animals, and the human beings that we see on our level. So in a sense, you could say Darwin had a correct idea. He wasn't completely wrong. All the living things do descend from a common ancestor. He thought, the mistake that Darwin made is he thought the common ancestor must have been some tiny one-cell creature that self-organized from chemicals. But actually, the common ancestor of all the living things in the universe is the most intelligent being, not the most simple. It's the most intelligent being. And so from Brahma come the Prajapatis, and then from the Prajapatis we get all the forms of the bodies for the living things. And according to the Vedic conception, bodies are vehicles for souls. That's what they are. They're not just chemical machines. They're vehicles for souls. And so we have an understanding why the universe actually exists. The material universe exists to give facility to souls who want to enjoy themselves apart from Krishna. And of course it's not a perfect place. The perfect place is the spiritual world. where all the souls are serving Krishna with love and devotion. For the souls that don't want to do that, they have to have another place, the material world. And of course, it's not going to be perfect. And they have to have material bodies in order to exist here. And those material bodies are designed to be subject to birth, death, old age, and disease. So, but in any case, all the bodies here can be traced back to Lord Brahma originally. Say, if you trace back your ancestors, to your father, your mother, your grandfather, your grandmother, your great-grandfathers, your great-grandmothers, if you trace them back according to the Vedic cosmology, you'll eventually come to some demigods. And then you trace their ancestry back, it'll go back to Brahma. So that's why, Brahma, he's known as the grandfather of everyone. Now, according to what most people learn in school, if you trace your ancestors back, you'll come to some ape men, and then you trace them back further, and you'll come to some apes or monkeys that existed millions of years ago, and if you trace them back further, you come to some primitive little mammals. If you trace them back further, you come to some reptiles, and you trace them back further, you come to some fish. And then you trace them back further, you come to some amoeba, and finally to some first single cell creature. That's what they teach in the modern schools, which is a completely false idea. So if you trace your ancestry back, really you'll come to some first Prajapati or something like that. And in Vedic culture, people have something called gotra. So for any cultured person in India, you can ask, what is your gotra? So gotra means your ancestry, where you come from. Who is your original ancestor? So the original ancestor is, like, for example, Srila Prabhupada, his gotra was the Gautam gotra. As Gautama, he was one of the original sages, from that came from Lord Brahma. And so his gotra was the Gautam gotra. And then others come from Bhartaraj and this sage and that sage. So any cultured person in India, you can ask them their gotra and they'll be able to tell you. And on that basis, if you go to some, you go to a temple in India, the priests, they want to perform some yajnas for you and things like that. But the first thing they do is they ask your gotra. So when Prabhupada's disciples went to India, they would get this question. So they asked Prabhupada, he said, Prabhupada, when we go to the temples, the pujaris, they ask us our gotra, so what should we say? And Prabhupada said, you say achyuta gotra. Which means you come from the gotra of Krishna. because Krishna is your original ancestor. Like that. So, I remember, I was, a few years ago, I was giving some lectures in South India, and between the lectures, the organizers would take me to different temples, and the priest would ask me, what is my gotra? And I'd say, Achyuta Gotra. And they go, oh, very nice. But then I thought, there's so many scientists in India who accept the theory of evolution. And they're Brahmins. They wear Brahmin thread and they go to the temple. And I thought, if they're going to be honest, then when the temple priest asks them what their gotra is, they should say monkey. they shouldn't say Gautam or Bhartaraj or this or that, because if they believe in the theory of evolution, that's not what they really think. They think if you trace your ancestors back, you'll come to some monkey. So they should say monkey gotra. So in Srimad Bhagavatam, we're learning many important things. So, Learning about advanced technology that existed in ancient times. Lord Brahma coming on his swan carrier, spacecraft from other planets. You know, they're looking now for life on other planets. But yes, there is. We learned that. Brahmaloka, there's life. On the sun planet, there's life. On the moon planet, there's life. This information is given there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then we're also learning something about our ancestry. So in terms of our material bodies, we can all trace them, you know, back to Brahma. And then, but also we get our first birth is from our parents. You know, our material body comes from our mother and father. And if we trace the material body back in time, it eventually goes to Brahma. But from the spiritual master, we get our second birth. But the spiritual master also comes in a line of succession. And our line of succession is the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya succession. So if we trace our spiritual ancestry back, you know, we go also, if we trace for those of us who are disciples of Srila Prabhupada, for example, his spiritual master was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and then you go back to Lord Chaitanya, and then back to Madhva, and then back to Narada, and then back to Brahma, because we're from the Brahma Sampradaya. So we're connected with, you know, Brahma in different ways. So we're learning here our family history. You know, everybody wants to know their family history. So here in this part of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and actually throughout the Bhagavatam, we're learning about many episodes of our family history, both in terms of our physical bodies, you know, our physical ancestry, and then also in terms of our spiritual ancestry. Okay. Any questions, comments? Archita.
Modern conception, but you know, the modern science was to say, well, that's not really proof that they actually existed. For instance, now there's a series on TV, Badri Narayan Prabhu had sent around an email saying everybody should maybe look at it and maybe even tape it, but then he later on rescinded that because it's called A Story of India. And it's very nice high production values, they're showing you, you know, their version of the history of India, but it all comes down to, for instance, they talk about the plays depicting the life of Lord Ram, the Ramayana. But it's just mythology. It's just mythology. This great king that supposedly... It's just mythology. So similarly, they could say that the aircraft story was just mythology. Just like even in Western culture, we had Jules Verne writing about submarines before they existed. We had, you know, guys writing about Dick Tracy talking into a watch. And now they actually exist. So obviously somebody was just dreaming that up in the past, and now it came to... So similarly, you know, you were dreaming of aircraft way back then, and then eventually they came into being.
Well, crazy people can say so many things. So it depends what we accept as evidence. So we have to understand something about, you know, the Vedic epistemology. And according to the, you know, Vedic epistemology, you know, there are two ways of getting knowledge. One is called the ascending path of knowledge, which means sense evidence, you know, looking at things we can perceive with our senses, and then, you know, thinking about it with our minds to try to draw some conclusions about what may exist or not exist. And this is the method, you know, followed by, you know, the modern materialistic scientists. You know, they look at things, they look at the world with their senses or with their scientific instruments, which are the extensions of their senses, and they try to, with their minds, to logically draw some conclusions about the nature of the world, what's in it, what's existed, or what exists or what doesn't exist. This is a very imperfect path of knowledge because actually the senses are all limited. You know, if you look at each sense, the eyes, the nose, the ears, you'll find it's limited in certain ways. You know, for example, we can't see, you know, all the, you know, we can only see a certain part of the spectrum of light. You know, there's ultraviolet, infrared things that we can't see. So each sense is limited. We can only hear a certain frequencies of sound. Actually, I was reading that to prevent crime, prevent stealing in stores and things like that, they've developed a kind of ultrasound that only teenagers can hear. Makes this loud, piercing noise. Our senses are actually limited. And then the mind, you know, it makes mistakes, it becomes illusioned, it cheats or it becomes the victim of cheating. And you know, if you look at the whole history of science, you'll find that every scientific theory that's ever been proposed has later been shown to be wrong. You know, they're always coming up with some new idea, you know. So this method of getting knowledge is extremely imperfect. And therefore, if we want certain knowledge, if we want absolute knowledge, and even scientists, they admit we're not providing absolute knowledge. This is what they actually consider to be one of their good points, to say, no, we're presenting relative knowledge. You know, the best conclusion that we have now, and we're always willing to change our idea, and, you know, that means they're never going to get certain knowledge. That means it's always going to be changing. You know, what they think is real, what is not real. So in Vedic culture, people were interested in absolute certain knowledge, not in temporary, provisional knowledge, relative knowledge. They were interested in absolute knowledge, certain knowledge. And there's only one way that you can actually get that. The only way you can get that is if there is a source of absolute certain knowledge, if there is a conscious being that is not limited, by you know, the senses and imperfect mind. Now, fortunately, there is such a personality. There's the Supreme Personality of Godhead who has absolute, perfect, certain knowledge of everything that exists. And that knowledge comes to us by another process. You know, it comes through the descending path of knowledge, which is based on the idea, yes, there is a perfect source of all knowledge. He can give us that knowledge and does so in the form of shabda, transcendental sound, which is actually recorded in the Vedic literature. So from that source, we get this knowledge. Now, Srila Prabhupada admitted, when he was talking with the devotees of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, he said, they were discussing, well, what the scientists will say, you know, and he said, yes. They'll say, yes, whatever you say is mythology. And then we just say back to them, you don't accept our source of knowledge, we don't accept your source of knowledge. Everything you're saying is completely untrue, a mistake, lies, cheating. So then that's the position. So they don't accept our source of knowledge, we won't accept their source of knowledge. But we accept our source of knowledge. You know, so they may say like that, oh yes, it's all mythology. And we say, you're just a bunch of liars and cheaters. And all your knowledge is imperfect. You know, so they don't accept our source of knowledge, we don't accept their source of knowledge. How do you know there weren't any spacecraft in ancient times? Were you there to see whether there were or weren't? You know, they can only say no. So Srila Prabhupada wanted us to establish the authority of the Vedic literature as a genuine source of knowledge. And actually, testimony you know, verbal testimony is a kind of evidence. Yeah, that's okay. Who had the next? Okay, first Swivas. The question is their ideas of mythology, does it also relate to, you know, Greek mythology? Of course, Srila Prabhupada was once asked, for example, is the idea of the Vedic demigods similar to the idea of the Greek demigods? And he said, yes. So they may have had a picture of reality that was actually, you know, closer to the truth than what they have now. The Greeks and the Romans, they may have had a picture of reality that wasn't quite perfect, but it was actually closer to the truth than the ideas that they have now, which is a completely impersonal universe. At least they had the idea there are persons in control, personalities in control of the forces of nature and things like that. They didn't have the complete, perfect understanding, but they were closer to the truth than today's scientific picture of the world is. They can consider, yes, we are, you know, reacting, you know, against, you know, what the Greeks believed, but what the Greeks actually believed was closer to the truth than what they now think the truth is by their scientific methods. If we look at, say, the European languages, we see they're all related to Sanskrit. And, you know, German, French, Italian, Spanish, English, all these languages are related to Sanskrit, which indicates that the culture was also related to the culture of the Sanskrit-speaking people. Now, this was a big shock for the Europeans when they discovered this, you know, in the 18th century. So they began trying to explain it in some way. I mean, one obvious idea was that their language and culture and people were related to the Sanskrit-speaking people and culture, which means actually they came from that source. But they didn't like that idea. So they came up with this idea that, yes, there's some relationship between, you know, the Europeans and the Sanskrit-speaking people, but the relationship is that those Sanskrit-speaking people started out in Europe. And then they went to India. You know, so that's the theory that they came up with, that, you know, originally it was the European culture and the Sanskrit culture and Indian culture came from Europe. You know, usually they say from southern Russia. And then went to India and established the Vedic culture there. They have a technical name for this. They call it the Aryan invasion idea. You know that. So that way, they could say that they were superior, you know, that they were the origin. But we don't get that idea from the Vedic literature itself. It never says that, yes, we originated in Europe, and then we came to India. And, you know, it doesn't say that. You know, the Vedic culture was always present in India. So this is another question that we have to deal with, you know, in the scientific world and academic world, you know, establishing, you know, for example, I mean, we always say 5,000 years ago, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So Srila Prabhupada makes a big deal of that. This Kurukshetra is a real place. You can go to it. it's 150 kilometers north of Delhi. You can go there. It's in Haryana state. There's a train station there. It's not a mythological place. It's a real place. And 5,000 years ago, there was a huge battle there. And there were also cities like Hastinapur and Dwarka and Mathura. There were Vedic cities. Now, according to what most scientists believe today, and most historians believe today, they think there was no Vedic culture in India at that time. They think there were only some primitive non-Vedic people there, some little towns and villages, and then later, maybe about 1500 BC, about 3500 BC, the first Sanskrit-speaking people came from Europe into India. And this way they kind of justified their colonial rule of India. The Buddha says, yes, we're just your original brothers coming back to help you. You know, like that. So, okay, it's actually we're past time and I like to stick to the schedule, so we'll stop now. We can continue later. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.